Perhaps you've heard the old joke, based on Leonardo da Vinci's famous painting of the Last Supper. Just before he shared bread and wine, Jesus looked at the disciples and said, "Okay, everyone who wants into the picture, get on this side of the table." That is so wrong on so many levels. In addition to being in very, very bad taste, both archaeology and history tell us that the table they used for that supper probably wasn't like that at all. It was probably a rather low three-sided affair. In addition, Jesus and the disciples wouldn't have been sitting on chairs. Reclining was the way that almost everyone back then took their meals. And then there was the room itself. The way Da Vinci rendered it, well, it had more in common with a 15th century Italian villa than a first century Palestinian upper room. Several years ago, I was at a meeting in a church that had its very own version of that very famous painting. As I looked at it, I noticed that something was wrong with it, even more than the fact that it had been painted on velvet. It was a velvet Da Vinci. It took me a while, but I finally realized that the feet underneath the table didn't match up to the respective bodies. Disjointed heels and toes were just everywhere. It was a troubling sight, to say the least, one that still haunts me today. Even before Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code came along, The Last Supper was a very, very well-known work. Yet it is also a very, very wrong depiction of that very famous night. Nevertheless, it does give us a very good starting point to begin discussing what happened on Thursday of the most important 7 days ever, that week we now call Holy Week. Today will simply be a day to remember the story. Before we start, however, please recall that we have spent the last few Sundays asking why Jesus had to die. What caused the Roman officials, with the full support of the Jerusalem establishment, to nail Jesus to a bloody cross? We have answered that question as we have learned that Jesus spent the first 4 days of Holy Week alienating and aggravating almost everyone in power. The Romans on Sunday, the temple movers and shakers on Monday, the local clergy on Tuesday, and even his own disciples on Wednesday. Now, Jesus was smart. He was well aware that all of that aggravation and alienation would probably not end well. But now all of those actions were past. It was now Thursday, and his greatest desire was simply to spend some time with his disciples. After all, as you heard me tell the children, it was Passover, the most important day on Israel's calendar. As Judas had already been looking for an opportunity to betray him, not revealing the location of the meal beforehand would surely have been a concern for Jesus. So Mark tells us that early on Thursday, he sent two of his disciples ahead of him to make preparations for that meal. It seems obvious that Jesus had made reservations beforehand. After finding the man that Jesus told them to find, the two disciples, probably Peter and John, were directed to a large upper room. And it was there that they set to work. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the time the Passover lambs were slain in the temple, Peter and John would have gone to that holy place with a lamb of their own. Once ritually slaughtered and then butchered, the two would have returned to that room where they would have basted that lamb in oil or wine and then roasted it, for several hours. Other dishes would have also been prepared. At about 7 o'clock that evening, Jesus and the rest of the disciples would have entered the room and joined them. Others, probably some of the women who had traveled with them all the way from Galilee, would have also probably been in that room. And there they would have all settled down to begin to eat the Passover meal. The Passover, of course, was the yearly celebration of the most important moment in Israel's history. Sort of like our Thanksgiving and 4th of July all rolled into one. It was a time when families and friends would come together to remember their collective history with a joyous ritual meal. Gathering around that table, they would recount the story of how their ancestors had been slaves of Egypt for over 400 years when God finally heard their cries and called Moses to go and do battle with Pharaoh. Moses demanded, "Let my people go." When Pharaoh refused, God sent a series of 10 plagues upon Egypt. And each time, as you probably know, Pharaoh responded with a hard heart. It was then that God decided to send one final plague on Egypt, one so terrible that it would finally break Pharaoh's heart of stone and free his people. God would strike down the firstborn of every household throughout the land. The Israelites were told to sacrifice a lamb and then mark their doorpost with its blood. Death would pass over only those households that were marked by the blood of the lamb. They were also told that the remains of that lamb were to be cooked and eaten quickly, along with bread that had not yet had time to rise, as the time of their deliverance would not be long in coming. Chapter 12 of Exodus predicted that the meal would become a joyful remembrance of everything that God had done for the children of Israel. And it did. That was the meal that Jesus and his followers gathered to eat on that Thursday night in the upper room. Now, even with the celebratory nature of that meal, there had to be a sense of apprehension and foreboding in that upper room. Everyone around that table had to be aware of the tensions that Jesus' activity over the past few days had created. Everyone had to know that dark clouds were surely ahead. With all that had happened, that they had to imagine, we have to imagine that they would have been on pins and needles just wondering what it was that was going to happen next. Well, Jesus didn't let them wonder too much longer. At some point during the meal, he looked out over those who had been with him for so long and said, one of you is going to betray me. Horrified, the disciples started looking at one another, questioning themselves and even asking, "Is it I?" Jesus knew who it was, but he didn't come right out and say it. Rather, he said that it is one of the 12, one who is dipping his bread in the bowl with me. First century table customs were much, much different from ours. Several diners would have shared the same bowl of food. So it was on that night. Judas was obviously sitting right next to Jesus. Mark does not comment upon why Judas decided to betray Jesus. Rather, Mark concentrates on the fact that he was one of the 12 and that he was present at the table that night. He was one of the 12 and he was present at the table. If you remember nothing else about that story, please remember that. You probably know that eating together was important during biblical times. Meals were considered to be far more than simply an occasion to receive physical nourishment. Someone wrote that being welcomed at a table for the purpose of eating food with another person had become a ceremony of richly symbolic friendship, intimacy, and unity. You can't read the Gospels and not know that Jesus just loved to eat with other people. That is also, you may remember, one of the things that got Jesus in trouble. In a time when society had very, very strict boundaries, he didn't have any qualms about who ate at his table. The religious officials, of course, accused him of ignoring religious sensibilities and eating with tax collectors and sinners. And their accusations were correct. Jesus, you may remember, had lunch with Zacchaeus, who was Jericho's chief tax collector. He had dinner with Simon the leper, one whose illness was popularly ascribed to sin. He ate with women of questionable reputation and men who were not held in high regard. And this particular night, this particular Thursday night was no different. As I mentioned, all 12 of the disciples would have been seated around that table. Around that table was Judas, who was already making plans to betray him. Peter, who later that night would deny him. And so many of the others who in one form or another would hightail it and run when push came to shove. If there was ever an unworthy group of diners, then those around that table had to be it. But there they were, eating the Passover meal with Jesus. I don't know about you, but every time I lose hope or confidence in myself or maybe even in my faith, I remember the fact that all 12 of the disciples, even Judas, sat at that table with Jesus. There is something comforting in knowing that amidst the gathering storm, amidst the sin, ignorance, and betrayal that Jesus knew was about to take place within that group of followers, that those were the people. Those were the people with whom Jesus chose to share food and drink. Those were the people that Jesus chose to serve. Those were the people with whom Jesus wanted to spend his very last night on earth. If Jesus could sit with them, then Jesus must certainly be able to sit with me. But forgive me, I got off track. I started preaching. I'm supposed to be telling you the story, so let me get back to it. While they were eating the meal and reliving the Passover, Jesus took a piece of that unleavened bread, and after blessing it, he broke it, gave it to them, and said, "Take, this is my body." Even knowing the mounting tensions, the disciples must have been confused. What could he have meant by those words? Nevertheless, they took that bread and they ate. Then Jesus took one of the cups that was being used to remind them of the covenant that God had made with the Israelites on Mount Sinai and used it to remind them of the new covenant that God made and was promised through the prophet Jeremiah. After blessing it, he passed that cup around and said, "Drink, this is my blood of the new covenant poured out for many." Once again, no doubt confused, they each drank from the cup. I can't imagine they said a lot as they did. It's hard to know just what they may have been thinking. It wouldn't be till after Easter, after all, until all this started to make sense to them. All we know for sure is what Mark tells us, that after the meal was finished, perhaps 11 o'clock in the evening or so, They all sang a hymn, probably a hymn known as the Hallel, which is composed of parts of the 118th Psalm and is traditionally used to bring the Passover meal to an end. One of the interesting things about the Hallel is it contains the words, "The stone that the builders have rejected has become the chief cornerstone." Surely those words meant nothing to the disciples at the time. Well, once they had finished the hymn, Judas departed the scene, while the others, along with Jesus, headed out to the Mount of Olives and the grove known as the Garden of Gethsemane. Things happened quickly now. As he did so often as he walked with his friends, Jesus started a discussion. "You will all become deserters." Though Peter protested those words, Jesus persisted. One has to wonder if their future desertion bothered Jesus even more than Judas' upcoming betrayal. No one wants to be alone, not even Jesus. To think that those with whom he had become so close, those with whom he had been through so much, would run in an attempt to save their own skin had to be disheartening to them. Adam Hamilton has commented that he is glad that this major bit of embarrassment made its way into the Gospels. Knowing that those closest to him failed their Lord, and knowing what happened when they finally knew the truth, it is strangely comforting to him. And I would have to agree. But once again, both Adam and I got to preaching. It's sort of a hazard of the profession. So we need to get back to the story. The word Gethsemane means olive press. Olive press. It was here in the middle of this grove that olives would be put under extreme pressure in order to extract their oil. That's where it would happen. What an appropriate place for Jesus to experience the extreme pressure of what was to come. While the disciples slept, Jesus prayed, pleading, "Abba, Father." You probably know that while the word Abba is nowadays associated with the song Dancing Queen, it actually is an old Aramaic word that is loosely translated as daddy or papa. The word suggests that Jesus felt an intimacy with God that was like the relationship between a parent and a child. He used that prayer to pray for deliverance. To no one's surprise, he would rather not go through what was ahead of him. Even so, he placed himself in his Abba's hands. One has written, this prayer reflects not the fatalistic resignation to the will of God, but trusting in God, even in the midst of the most dire of circumstances. Even as he entered that shadowed valley, you see, he knew that his God, his Abba, was with him. Immediately after the prayer, Judas entered Gethsemane with a crowd carrying swords and clubs. Much has been made of the fact that Judas identified his master with a kiss. But we must remember two things. First, that was and that is a very normal way of greeting in that particular part of the world. For people of Mediterranean descent, a kiss is almost like a handshake. Second, those coming to arrest Jesus would probably not have been those whom Jesus had offended earlier in the week. More than likely, these were simply the temple police or Roman soldiers who would not have necessarily known who Jesus was. The kiss was probably nothing more than a way of greeting and a means of identification. And it was with that kiss It was with that kiss that the events of Friday were put into motion. William Barclay reminds us that on every long airplane flight, there comes a point that the pilot knows as the point of no return. From then on, he cannot go back, and he must go on. From that moment, he has passed the point where return is possible. Just so it is true that in every human exploit, Barclay writes, and in every human undertaking, there comes that point of no return, that moment when the way back ceases to be possible, and when there is nothing left to do but to go on. For Jesus, that moment came in the Garden of Gethsemane. The hour, as Jesus had said so many times before, was upon them. And the only appropriate response for the disciples back then, just as the only appropriate response for disciples today, is to watch and pray. As you watch, let us pray. Amen.